From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Next up, we have an interview with another Vermont author. When he's not cutting next winter's firewood, pulling weeds in the garden, or off on an adventure with his wife, Patricia, Michael Friedthal is probably staring at his computer waiting for inspiration. When he retired after 30 years as a teacher and principal in Vermont schools, he took up writing. He became active with the Burlington Writers' Workshop, co-edited one of their yearly anthologies, and published four short stories. The Vermont Studio Center accepted him into their week-long summer writing camp, and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs chose him to participate in their writer-to-writer mentorship program. These opportunities helped him finish his first book, Horodno Burning, which is a novel about literature, freedom, and Jewish survival. We're going to speak with Michael in just a few minutes. Probably 1 minute. But first, I want to just tell you a little bit about his book. In the Russian Empire's Pale of Settlement, Esther Leving, a brilliant young bibliophile, chafes at male dominance, religious dogma, and anti-Semitism. Bernard Garfinkel, a religious Jew and the son of a vodka distiller, hides a shameful secret. In a culture that worships books, he can't read. Despite their differences, they fall in love. Esther teaches Bernard to read, and he, in turn, builds her a bookshop. They start a family, but when ferocious pogroms target Russian Jews, they must confront violent oppression. Exploring the turbulent history of the late 19th century that led to the migration of 1.5 million Jews from Tsarist Russia to America, Horodno Burning is a love letter to literature, freedom, and Jewish survival. So with me now is Michael Friedthal. Michael, welcome to Write the Book.
Thank you, Shayla.
It's great to have you
here. Good to be here.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to talking to you about Horodno Burning. I thought we would talk first a little bit about the Pale of Settlement in Russia and the village of Horodno and its history in the time period of your book, which is late 19th and early 20th century. So did you already know a lot about this area of the world and the history of its people when you started working on this book, or how did that come about?
I wouldn't say I knew a lot. I think, like many Jews, I had a vague idea that my ancestors came from that part of Eastern Europe.
Uh-huh.
But if you ask me specifically what modern-day countries would it comprise, I would have been hard-pressed to give you an accurate answer.
Yeah.
Now I can say with a good degree of confidence that it included what would be modern-day Lithuania, Belarus, Moldova, most of modern-day Ukraine, and a good chunk of modern-day Poland.
Okay. All right, great. And Horodno, in your title, is a village within that area. Is that correct?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Go ahead. I think you're going to say the same thing I was going to say.
Okay. That's the Yiddish version of a real town called Grodno today.
Okay.
But that's the Jews knew it as Horodno.
Okay. And that was a town that also had a role to play in World War II. Is that correct? I remember reading about that.
Well, it was this whole area of Europe was pretty much, the ground, the killing ground of the Holocaust. Like Lithuania, 90% of the Jews were murdered in World War II. And Grodno was, Jewish population was pretty much destroyed as well. Although there is, I found out, it's still a synagogue and a renewed Jewish community in Grodno today.
Wow. Okay, interesting. Now, you said a little bit about your inspiration, but let's just go deeper into that. What inspired you to write Horodno Burning?
Well, I started out thinking I was writing a memoir, My parents passed away in 2009, and by 2011, I had just retired. I had a lot of time on my hands, and I decided it would be fun to learn a little bit more about my ancestry. So I did the Ancestry.com thing, and I spoke to relatives I had never spoken to before, like distant cousins. And I tried to piece together as much of their lives their ancestors, my right. ancestors, as I could. But I found two things. One is that it's a lot more fun to write fiction because, as you know, as a fiction writer, you're not as bound by, you're freer to bring in imagination and to make connections and so on. And the second thing was, I had those fragments, and I became totally fascinated by the 19th century. Basically, between 1881 and 1914 is when most American Jews can trace their immigration to America back to. And it was certainly the case with me. And I became very interested in the rich life, and as well as the conflicts of that time period that drove such a great migration. Mm-hmm. It was very, very rich to write about. There were external conflicts with anti-Semitism and restrictive laws. Women's movement was just really getting going in Russia, and it was pretty much stronger than what we had in our country at that time. Mm-hmm. And then there were the internal conflicts. So when things started falling apart for the Jews, there was a brief interlude where things were looking much better under one of the czars who, not that he was a Democrat by any stretch of the imagination, but his philosophy is more like, if we liberate people from above, they won't rebel from below. So he liberated, Alexander II liberated the serfs. He had much more tolerant laws towards Jews and so on. So for a while, it looked like things were getting better, and then everything fell apart in 1881, and Jews had decisions to make. They could emigrate or they could stay was one basic decision. The ones who emigrated came to America.
Right.
And the ones who stayed could either have assimilated or just continued to practice their religion and hope for the best, or they could stay and fight. And many Jews made up the revolutionary movements of the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your specific fictional narrative within this setting and time period that we're talking about. And I want to just preface this question by quoting the writer Janet Burraway, who famously wrote that only trouble is interesting, and that is why conflict is so fundamental to fiction. And actually, that's not a quote. That's me paraphrasing her. But anyway, so I love the inherent conflicts in your novel. This is a love story, and Esther and Bernard are your protagonists. And Esther is an intellectual who loves to read, and she strives to be a writer. She's very opinionated. And Bernard, you know, he has a great mind, but he cannot read. So that's a wonderful conflict right there. And then another conflict, and this is, I'm going to quote from a Kirkus review of the book. They did a great job. They gave you a great review. And they write, Bernard is devoutly spiritual, and Esther tends to see religious belief as an instrument of thoughtless prejudice. So those are wonderful conflicts right there within your main character's relationship. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about weaving conflict into the novel in such a way that readers are drawn in and the characters become richer and maybe more interesting.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because just maybe an hour ago, my wife read a quote to me, supposedly attributed to Kurt Vonnegut, that basically all novels are a character digging a hole and spending the rest of the book trying to climb out of it. So I thought that was very, very right on the mark.
That's great.
Yeah, I think as a novelist, you know, we're looking for without conflict, it's just sort of a placid day at the beach, and it, you know, it's not going to hold anybody's attention. There's nothing at stake. So this would, you know, the characters were quite different. As you mentioned, Estes is a real intellectual, totally frustrated by lack of opportunity for women, but both within Russia, but also within the Jewish culture, because, for example, men and women had to sit separately at synagogue. Mm-hmm. Men basically went off to study while the women kept the house. Within the households, I think women had a lot of power, but it wasn't really shown by their status in society. So you have her, she's chafing under that. And then Bernard, as you said, he's hiding this, for him, a terrible, terrible secret. He thinks it's going to be the greatest tragedy of his life. And he basically manages to hide this from his father and his rabbi with the help of some of his classmates. He has a lovable rabbi in school, but the rabbi's kind of a little bit befuddled, hard of hearing, doesn't see real well. And Bernard manages to pull off a ruse that he can read. But eventually, you know, when he meets Estes, she has to make a decision once she learns that he can't read. At one point, I think she says in her journal, if he had been a book, I would have returned him to the shelf unopened. You know, if she had known that he had that problem right off the bat. But she got to know him first, and that made all the difference.
Yeah,
and
I thought that was great.
To teach.
Sorry. That was a great line.
Yeah, thank you. She's determined to teach him to read, and she's a very determined teacher. I think the what she says at one point is all your other teachers, it was like putting a pot of water on the stove to simmer. You never came to a boil. But she turns the heat right up, and he does eventually learn to read.
Now, Michael, do you tend to know where a story is going as you begin to write? Or in the case of this one, did you know where this book was going to go? Did you play around with multiple endings, or did you kind of figure it out early on?
I wish I had figured it out a little earlier, because I went down a number of dead ends. I guess, you know, I mean, there are probably many ways to approach writing a novel, but the two that I'm familiar with are you outline everything, do all your research, have an idea where it's going, and then write. And the other one is you just start writing the characters, develop the characters, and they'll tell you where the story's going. I went more with that latter approach.
Yeah.
And as a result, they changed their minds quite frequently on me. So I had to do quite a bit of rewriting. No, I didn't always know where it was going. I'd say by the time I got where I met you at the studio school.
Yes.
What was that, 3 or 4 years ago?
Yes.
But that was the week where I really had an idea. Okay, this is how this novel is going to wrap up. But up until then, I was not sure.
Now, you write novels the way I do, which is I do the same thing. I start to write. I try to figure out the characters. I kind of let it take me. But how long did it take you to write the book?
Well, it depends what you count as a starting date. Because I started with the idea of memoir.
Right. Oh, sure.
And it took me a while to toss that off. So I would say it was probably about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
But of that time, probably 3 years was writing and 4 years was the edit.
Yeah. It's a longer process, although I will say, having written a number of novels, it gets a little bit faster as you get used to the idea.
I'm very glad to hear that.
I want to ask, do you mind if I read a paragraph from your book?
Sure.
And then ask you a question about it. And it starts with a word I do not know how to say. I assume it's in Yiddish. Pogrom Shichiki? Is that how you would say that?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So
So the pogrom Shchukyi did not run away this time. Lieb got off three more shots before the wave crashed upon them. Bernard had never hit a human being, nor had anyone ever struck him in anger. His father had taught him violence was a sin, but when a cudgel struck him in the side, he wielded the iron without hesitation. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Joseph use his weapon like a club. Lieb disappeared in a pile of howling men, and I'm not going to say what happens or where that goes from there, but I wanted to ask you about writing violence, because there is violence in this book, and I'm wondering if you had any experience with violence yourself, first of all, which you don't have to talk about if you don't want to, but I'm just curious. Like, I don't know how I would go about writing violence.
I would say, I mean, it seems like we're all seeped in it if we've had any media at all. Even the evening news, sometimes I can't watch because it's so violent. So I think that was in there somewhere. And of course, all the books we read, you know, these things are all swirling around. So,
Yeah,
that part maybe, unfortunately, felt more natural to write than some of the other parts. But
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, too, if there isn't a lot of emotion building around the situation they find themselves in that releases itself through the same output that they have.
Well, you know, I had done a lot of reading about that particular pogrom. That was a real event.
Mm-hmm.
And the eyewitness accounts, and it was quite descriptive and quite detailed. So even though the characters in that situation are fictional,
mm-hmm.
Some of the other things, the assault of women and so on, was a feature of pogroms. So I wanted to not make that too horrible to read, but I also wanted to make it realistic.
Right. Okay. All right. Great. I love the cover of the book, which features Marc Chagall's The Flying Carriage. I was curious if you went to the Chagall exhibit when it was in Montreal.
I did not, but that painting is at the Guggenheim, and I've been waiting for a let up in COVID. To go down there. We've been to the Guggenheim before, but I probably saw the painting, but that was probably years before I had thought of using it for the cover. But I'm really looking forward to seeing the actual painting.
Yeah. And Chagall was from the same part of the world, too.
Yeah.
He was from the same...
He was a few hundred miles away from Hrodno, to the east, and much of his painting draws from his early experience in the Pale Settlement. The particular painting, The Flying Carriage, which he painted in 1913, which was the cover image, to me that had a mixture of folk art and modernism, and also the trauma and transcendence, which are rife in Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like almost too perfect a painting.
Yeah, it's a beautiful painting. That was an amazing show. I didn't know his work. Like, I'd never seen it up close until I went. I think I went to that show twice because it was so incredible. But I loved your cover. I was like, oh, I think that's Chagall. And then I looked and it was.
You're right. Good call.
Let's see. Michael, you actually gave me this question because I was asking you, what questions would you ask yourself? So you offered this question, and I thought it was a great one. What surprised you as you researched and wrote your novel?
Well, I think one of the things was I had sort of an image of Jews in the Pale Settlement as being just a totally miserable existence, and that they couldn't wait to leave, and that they were not allowed to leave. And it wasn't that way. I mean, the time period I'm writing about, again, was sort of a more tolerant czar.
Mm-hmm.
Nicholas the First had been pretty awful towards Jews. He had conscripted children as young as 12 into the army. And And then after Alexander II, his son, Alexander III, was just a brutal man, very anti-Semitic. But during this time period, I was surprised that things actually seemed to be improving for Jewish life in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Many more Jews were admitted into the inner part of Russia. Many more could go to university, become doctors, become professionals of various sort. And, there was a great hope that things were going to improve. And then the seminal event was the assassination of the Tsar in 1881.
Yeah.
And there was a Jewish woman who had a secondary role. She wasn't one of the main plotters. Her name was Gessia Gelfman. But somehow the Jews got blamed for the assassination. I think there was a lot of unrest in Russia at that time anyways because of the industrialization and the poverty.
Right.
So in 1881, everything kind of falls apart. The pogroms blow up. And what follows the pogroms is almost worse than the actual violent events. It was called the Maywalls. And I hadn't really known too much about that. But after the Jews were blamed not only for the assassination, but for the pogroms themselves. I think the Tsar said, you have nobody to blame but yourself for the exploitation of Russian society. Or maybe it wasn't him, but one of his advisors. But at any rate, it started a series of laws, which even within the Pale settlement started restricting where Jews could live. They could be evicted from their homes. A number of other restrictions
mm-hmm.
that were meant to humiliate or just to pacify the larger population by giving them a target to kind of lay all the troubles on. And so I was surprised by that there was that interlude of sort of hope, and then it all came apart in 1881.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, great. Michael, have you, I always like to ask if my guests have read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. Have you read like one or two titles that you could share with us?
Well, right now I'm reading Americana.
Oh, okay.
By Schmidt, I'm going to mess up her name, but Adichie.
Yep.
I'm enjoying that quite a bit.
Yeah.
A really tough read. You mentioned violence. I mean, this is, you got to have a pretty strong stomach for this one, but it's just amazing. It's an amazing story. It's The Constellation of Vivid Phenomena.
Oh, yeah.
A tough book, though, so one should go into that with their eyes open.
I have not read that yet, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, were you going to say another one? Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, for my novel, I'd gone back and read a ton of 19th century books. And, I mean, Jane Eyre.
Oh, yeah.
Probably everybody has read that, but sometimes those books are really fun to reread. Anna Karenina, Madame Bovary, those types of things.
Yeah.
Were a lot of fun.
Flaubert is like, I just love reading Flaubert because he's just so perfect.
Yeah.
He's just the perfect writer.
He is. And escaping into the 19th century, given our what's going on in the 21st, the fact that we can't travel, we can't go anywhere, that, it's another way to take a voyage.
Yeah.
And it both, I mean, there are some marvelous things in the 19th century, but also some of the hardships will give a reader perspective on our own times as well.
Yeah.
Maybe things aren't quite as bad as we think they are.
Let's see. Michael, I like to finish by asking for advice. And in your case, I was thinking I would ask you if you have any advice for blending history and fiction and knowing sort of like how much of the record to leave in, when it becomes too much information, sort of how to balance your narrative with the historical facts.
For me, the historical facts were a very valuable frame to hang the story from. So certain characters I wanted to make as realistic as possible. There's a writer in the story, Eliza Orzakova, who is actually the first woman writer nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature, and she plays a major role. Mm-hmm. And there were some other things I wanted to be as accurate as I could. I think when it comes to, like, the technology of the times, the literature, the history, I think it's important to make sure everything is possible. It doesn't have to have happened exactly the way you lay it out, but it has to at least be possible. So, you know, I had in terms of how the trains ran, the steam engine worked, that type of thing, I think that's important.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think it's fair game. I had a chess player who was a chess champion of the world at that time come to Hrodno to do an exhibition, and I'm sure he never came there. But
that's kind of fun.
For a good scene. Yeah, and then I think the way the mea culpa is for the historical novels is you put in a historical note at the end. And I've heard different opinions on that. I think some think, you shouldn't do that. But I almost felt like it was a confessional that I had to say, okay, look, this is what I made up. This is what was real, without overdoing that, because I just felt like that's important enough to have somebody come away with a completely wrong idea of the time period.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you. That's wonderful advice for writers who are listening. And I want to mention again, the name of your new novel is Hrodno Burning, published by Rootstock in Montpelier. And I've been speaking with Michael Fried Thal, who is my guest today and also the artist who wrote Hrodno Burning, the author of Hrodno Burning. So, Michael, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, too. Thank you, Sheila.
And take care, and good luck with your launch of this book.
Thank you very much.
This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Sheila Connor Shapiro. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Fried Thal, Vermont author. You can learn more about his work at michaelfriedthal.com. In my conversation with Michael, just like 2 minutes ago, he said, use history as a frame from which to hang characters, or that's what he was trying to do in blending history and narrative. He was trying to use history as a frame to hang his characters from. I thought that was great advice, and I liked his follow-on, which is to make sure everything is possible, you know, technologically. Make sure that you have done your research and that you are representing that historical period accurately within the larger or the smaller story that you're telling, the narrative that you're telling within that time period. This week's Write the Book prompt is try to consider hanging your characters from the frame of history as you work on a story or a poem or an essay or maybe something longer that you're working on. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. You can find the archived episodes of Write the Book wherever you find your podcasts. I think most of the larger venues will have about 20 to 30 episodes, maybe 50 episodes, but there are 700 episodes of Write the Book, and soon to be 702, at the main Write the Book website, which is writethebook.podbean.com. You can also visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it where you find it. Like it on Facebook, tell all your friends. Okay, I'm Sheila Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.